that's this chunk of the internet.
Yeah, it's everything deja
old
vu.
Is new again.
What was that, Rob?
I just said everything old is new again.
Yeah, deja vu was my first thought when you mentioned that. But it is truly seemingly the same in that a lot of the count for its dominance is the integration into the mobile operating system. So people with smartphones having this as a default browser built into that system software necessitates the reliance on it in that particular platform. And there's just a lot of those phones out there. So those, I would imagine, I mean, those numbers are in large part due to the lack of choice that a lot of users experience. That is in stark contrast to what you'd expect on a desktop, where you do have a bunch of different choices, and that was hard fought. And I wonder if the same thing is itself happening again, because it feels so familiar I don't know. It also reminds me of looking at a USB-C cable. I'm reminded of the initiative in Europe to force Apple to change some of their hardware specifications. And that pressure actually did pay off. So some of these things, like if it's strategic and makes sense to something that is a poor business practice or behavior, there's a place for this grievance. And I like to see more intelligent stuff. And I hopefully this yields some kind of adjustment in the business practices.
You know, I think a large part of the problem is we don't realize what we're dealing with as far as who's behind it. Is it Google? Is it Alphabet? Yeah, it's all the same entity. You know, we have to say this is Google. Waze is Google. Chrome is Google. Nest is Google. YouTube is Google. They all are Googles. Let's stop calling them different names and start referring to them as their company, their parent company that is controlling everything. And then I think you'll see, you know, some of the problems that tend to repeat. We're talking about Chrome allowing far more ads and not allowing consumers to block ads like Firefox does. You know, I was watching the parade from Beijing yesterday. Did anybody see that? It was the 80th anniversary of their military victory over Japan. In fact, the name of this thing, it was the Conference to Commemorate the 80th Anniversary of the Victory of the Chinese People's War of Resistance Against Japanese Aggression and the World Anti-Fascist War. I'm not kidding. That's what the parade and the whole thing, the whole celebratory day was called. So, you know, I'm watching this on state television from China on YouTube, on Google. And that's good. You know, that's what a service like that should provide. Interrupted every 8 minutes by an ad for laundry detergent. And, you know, you can laugh at the name of the parade, but I think the more absurd player here is us. We're having to inject selling products into everything. I really don't think the Chinese Communist Party was monetizing coverage of their parade. I really don't think so. It just makes us look like complete idiots throughout the entire planet. And Google's leading the way as far as that goes. Anyway, enough of that. That's how I feel about what they're doing, how they're polluting the internet with consumerism. Like aggressive consumerism. Doge has put critical Social Security data at risk. I think we warned that this might happen, that this probably would happen. But yeah, members of the Department of Government Efficiency uploaded a copy of a crucial Social Security database back in June to a vulnerable cloud server, putting the personal information of hundreds of millions of Americans at risk. There are only hundreds of millions of Americans, aren't there? What's the population? It's like, what,
a couple hundred,
400, 500 million? Yeah, it's not that many. So pretty much everybody's information put at risk of being leaked or hacked. So a database contained records of all Social Security numbers issued by the federal government. Now, that might not sound so bad until you realize that every Social Security number is issued by the federal government. That's all the Social Security numbers. Everybody gets one. When you're born, you get one. You used to have to apply for one, but now you get one when you're born. So they're all up there. They're all, it includes individuals' full names, addresses and birth dates, among other details that could be used to steal their identities, making it one of the nation's most sensitive repositories of personal information. Now, this whistleblower named Charles Borges underscores concerns, and he since had to resign, concerns that have led to lawsuits seeking to block young software engineers at the agency built by Elon Musk from having access to confidential government data. In his complaint, Borges said Doge members copy the data to an internal agency server that only Doge could access, foregoing the type of independent security monitoring normally required under agency policy for such sensitive data and creating enormous vulnerabilities. Now, there's no indication yet that this database has been breached or used inappropriately, but his disclosure stated that as of late June, no verified audit or oversight mechanisms existed to monitor what Doge was using the data for or whether it was being shared outside the agency. We may never know, in other words. And Alex, welcome back.
Yes, thank you. I am back indeed.
So, yeah, I don't know if you heard our story about Doge acting like idiots and compromising all of our data.
Yeah, I walked into this story, I think, halfway through where, you know, just like every other story, I guess it was, you know, putting all of Americans' data at risk is kind of
only hundreds of millions. Heard. Only hundreds of millions of Americans.
Oh, only hundreds. Yeah. Okay, hundreds of millions. That's fine. That's not terrible. Could be worse.
Well, the current U.S. population, according to census.gov, is 342,423,216.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Doge. Thank you very much for that. That's more stupidity that we are seeing unravel in front of us. Okay. Here's something else. Alex, I think you might find this interesting. An activist has started using artificial intelligence to identify ICE agents beneath their masks. A use of the technology sparking new political concerns over AI-powered surveillance. Dominic Skinner is a Netherlands-based immigration activist. He estimates that he and a group of volunteers have publicly identified at least 20 ICE officials recorded wearing masks during arrests. He told Politico his experts are able to reveal a face using AI if they have 35% or more of the face visible. The AI-powered project adds a new twist to the debates over both ICE masking and government surveillance tools. It's kind of refreshing to see the tools used against them for a change. Alex, any thoughts on this?
I mean, I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander here. And if ICE agents are going to be using facial recognition technologies and widespread surveillance networks in order to identify people that they suspect are here illegally within the United States, then I think it is just par for the course at that point to use the same types of technologies to identify ICE agents who are trying to evade any kind of accountability or transparency by operating by wearing masks. I mean, that just rubs me the wrong way from the outset, to have government agents enforcing the law wearing masks without any kind of accountability. And I think the use of technology in this way is really what we should be doing. It's what we, I think, need to be doing more of, quite frankly.
Yes, Rob.
What concerns me about this is the use of AI, and I would really like to see I would really like to know more about what AI they're using, what this underlying technology is, and how accurate it is, because accuracy in facial recognition is not great, and generative AI can invent things, and I don't think this is something we can depend on. I'm all for the idea. I think, you know, there should be no reason that ICE agents have the right to privacy. Every local cop on the street has a badge number that ostensibly, theoretically, would keep them accountable for their actions. And I don't think ICE agents have the right to any more privacy than that.
Don't cops also have their name on their badge?
Indeed, they do. And, you know, ICE agents going around, you know, without standard uniforms, they could just, you know, have whatever they want on, no identifying info. That's crap. But I think trusting generative AI to identify their faces, I think there's a lot of danger in that.
What I'm really curious about, and I'm surprised this hasn't become a major issue, when people with masks on that have no identifying labels whatsoever are grabbing people off the streets, does anybody think maybe they're not members of law enforcement? Maybe they are just masked thugs grabbing people off the streets, and maybe people should defend themselves against these masked thugs? How has that not happened already?
It is happening, and there are a lot of cities, particularly where ICE has been acting significantly, where people are pretending to be ICE agents. They are committing felonies. There are people who are dressing up as ICE agents and blocking their faces and sexually assaulting dozens of women because they can, because there's no accountability right now. And for everyone to say, oh, ICE needs to hide their faces for their own safety. If you can't do your job with your whole chest, then you shouldn't be doing it. And if you don't want to say to people, oh, I'm an ICE agent, then don't be an ICE agent. It was like when I yelled at the kids who were working at the haunted house. I was like, how do you live with yourself? Your job is to make people scared and uncomfortable. How do you live with yourself?
Wait, hold on a second. You yelled at people in a haunted house? Kids love to be scared. I mean, you're shaming the people that bring joy to kids?
Right. So I was a senior in college. Uh-huh. I'm not a huge Halloween person, but my friends were like, hey, we're going to Not Scary Farm. And the guy I had a crush on was going. So I went, and I was in the food court drinking something, and someone came up to me and went, ooh, and I just snapped. And I said, how do you look at yourself in the mirror?
The haunted house had a food court?
No. It was Not Scary Farm. So it was like
I don't know what that is. What is Not Scary Farm? I don't know what
that means. Knott's Berry Farm, which is a theme park in Southern California. But they do a Halloween-themed extravaganza around Halloween. And it's spooky roller coasters, and there's haunted houses and all kinds of things going on. And I was in the food area, and someone came up at me and shook a can of beans and went, ooh. And I said, how do you say hello to your mother? How do you look at yourself in the mirror? You get paid to prey on people's fears and vulnerabilities. You should be ashamed of yourself. I'm not directly comparing people who work at haunted houses to ICE agents, but I'm not doing that.
You know, I worked at a haunted house before we met. Longtime listeners to this program will remember the time I had to take a break over the Halloween season because my voice was too shot to do radio because I was screaming at people. But I had a lot of fun in that job. And in so many ways, you and I are a mixed marriage, I think.
Well, let's hope this doesn't turn contentious because there's a lot here. There's a lot here. I think we're spinning our wheels, though, in a tangent. So I want to get back to the masked ICE agents that are threatening the freedom of our country because this is really an issue. And it's an issue that, yeah, I know people don't like it when we talk about things like this, but things like this are happening, so we have to talk about them. When this becomes normal, it's very hard to get back to a state of actual normalcy where these kinds of things don't happen. They're not stopping at people who are in the country without authorization. They will go after everybody using these tactics, and they will use the same excuse. They have to protect their identity because they're afraid of how people will react. But again, as Gila said, you know, maybe you shouldn't be doing this. If you're not proud of what you're doing, if you're not willing to stand up for what you're doing, then you shouldn't be doing it. There might be something wrong with what you're doing. And I think, you know, with that in mind, it makes sense to reveal as much information about these people as possible. Yes, I take Rob's point that the technology is not great and can get things wrong many times. You know, I think if you identify somebody and it turns out they work for ICE, then it's probable that that's the right person. But if it's somebody who has no connection to ICE, obviously that could be very bad. So I guess what I'm wishing for is for the technology to get better so that this kind of thing can be done, so that people walking around intimidating fellow citizens and non-citizens alike have to be accountable for their actions. Is that too much to ask? That's an awfully long pause for what I think was an obvious question, but go ahead, Alex.
No, I don't think so at all. And I think the masks and the pretextual reasons that we're hearing for the masks are all because what they're really afraid of is accountability. And that's, I think, a very, very sad state of affairs for a law enforcement agency at the federal level to have, I think, across the board right now with respect to these ICE agents and their activities. They're terrified of accountability, and I think, given Rob's, I think, very valid concerns, and putting them to the side for a moment, I think the use of technology to enhance this type of accountability is something that I think holds great promise.
Technology can be used in evil ways, and it can be used in good ways. I think it's up to all of us to take control of it and use it the way that we see fit. And this particular case, letting people know when there are actions in your neighborhood, or if you're able to reveal information that would hold people accountable, I think it's on all of us to use that technology responsibly.
Yeah, it should be something that you can count on. You should count on this immersion in technology. And I think, like you just mentioned, setting up systems to understand when these types of convoys are in different areas is totally valid, because you can expect certain ranges of frequencies or certain identifiers about certain types of actions that are predictable. And I think that's fair to be aware of how the technology is being used and know what it's associated with, like what kinds of actions, even if you're not able to get direct insight into what types of communications or what types of planning, fine, if that's obscure, there's still markers of various activity. And for people protesting certain actions, I think that their awareness and that kind of anticipation is crucial. Expect it. It's the tools that are being used, the ways that people are being cataloged with cameras and stuff like that. You should be doing just as much, especially for really, really egregious cases of abuse that you really need documentation. You really need some evidence to hold perpetrators accountable, especially ones that with these sorts of power or abusing power through subterfuge and hiding their identities.
That's going to have to be the last word, as we are out of time. Another edition of Off the Hook has come to an end. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. We'd love to hear your opinions. And, of course, we'll be back next week at 7 p.m. on Wednesday here on WBAI. We are not doing overtime this week on YouTube. That usually follows at 8 o'clock, but we will be doing that next week. Rob, I believe you have something to remind us of.
Check out your local 2600 meeting, 2600.com/meetings. Find one near you or start your own.
All right, we will see you next week. Remember to support WBAI. Give to WBAI.org. We'll see you next week. Good night.
You grew up in Kentucky. What was your...
I was an army brat.
Okay. What was your first crime?
First crime was shoplifting. My mom, and I've spoken about this a few times, but I'm from Eastern Kentucky. Hazard is coal country. My dad was coming out of the military. He was a captain in the Army, helicopter pilot. Army downsizes, he gets booted out. He goes back to mining coal, is what he does, strip mining. So a bulldozer operator is what he was doing. My mom was a nurse, an LPN, And she worked long enough to see Dad off to work, and then she would go out, and we call it whoring around. She would go out and party with other men, just horrible, horrible stuff, and just abuse out the wazoo. I remember one time, me and my sister come home. I was probably 8 or 9. My sister a year younger, and the bus drops us off. The hood of the car is up, so we walk by like that's odd. We walk in. Denise asks Mom.
So we walk in. Mom is sitting on the sofa in the living room with her legs crossed, acting all chill. I was like, what's wrong? What's up?
Yeah.
Where's Dad? I don't know, she said. I look on the floor and I see like pieces of marble broken off. The TV is pulled out from the wall. And I was like, What is this?
So there's some spaghetti on the stove. We go to get some. And Mom's like, no, don't touch that. Don't touch that. That's for your father. Well, what had happened was my mom had cut the spark plug wires on the car so Dad couldn't get away. She cuts the cable behind the TV so that when he goes to turn the TV on, there's no signal. You know, you just got the snow on there. So he gets behind the TV trying to see what's going on. As he bends over the TV, she takes a marble statue, clocks him in the head with it. The spaghetti on the stove had rat poison in it.
So he had ended up walking, I forget how many miles, to the hospital. And he still has a piece of that marble, like, in his skull.
Right.
But, of course, with us, her story when we'd gotten home was, I don't know where he is.
I don't know.
I don't know why that's on the floor.
That was my mom, and this is not atypical. I remember that when my dad, the one time he tried to divorce her, me and my dad were living in an apartment. My mom had my sister. My mom climbs in the window of the apartment. I wake up hearing this, you know, this noise in the living room, walk in, and my mom's got a knife to my dad's throat, threatening to kill him. That was my mom. So, and she was a criminal. So,
what was she so bent on killing him for?
My mom's problem was she always, and it's weird with her. I think it's because of the way she grew up. She grew up abused as well. But her issue is that she always had to test people's love. If I do this to you, will you still love me? If I sleep around on you, will you still love me? If I threaten to kill you, will you still love me? If I abuse the kids or neglect the kids, will they still love me? My dad was so crazy about my mom that he put up with it, and he became the enabler of the family. He was scared of losing her. But I get the worst parts from Mom and Dad. From my mom, I get that criminal mindset. From my dad, I get that fear of the people that I love leaving me. And that's a lot of the reason that I break crime historically. It's for cash, but I use cash to buy love.
These are true stories from the dark side of the internet. I'm Jack Reesider. This is Darknet Diaries.
Hey everyone, it's me, Simone Biles. As a world champion gymnast and a former foster kid, I've faced my fair share of complexity, and I've learned that the concept of controlling complexity is about more than just overcoming our own hardships. It's about helping others overcome theirs too. After all, in the face of enormous complexity, the best not only find a way to adapt to the challenge, they also find a way to give back. From now until the end of the year, Axonius will make a donation to Friends of the Children for every demo completed. For more details and to sign up, go to axonius.com/friends. That's axonius.com/friends.
So today we're going to hear the wild and crazy story of Brett Johnson. This is one of those stories that I was very skeptical at first. Like, no way did he do all this. But after talking with some people who knew him and reading all the police reports, it checks out. Oh, and I should mention there are a fair bit of swear words in this episode, and it has some adult and mature content. So, fair warning. Brett grew up in a weird situation. His dad was no stranger to doing illegal things. For instance, his dad was a helicopter pilot in the military, and one time his dad tried to sell some stolen hand grenades. And after the military, his dad tried running drugs back and forth to Mexico as a helicopter pilot. And at one point, he even tried becoming a cop with the sole idea that he was going to do a drug bust and somehow keep the money he confiscated. When all those plans fizzled out and the family had no money, that's when Brett's mom decided to take the kids and run.
At that point in time, we were in Panama City, Florida. My mom leaves my dad. Me and Denise thought we were coming up to Kentucky for a funeral. And we weren't. Well, I mean, there was a funeral, but we thought we were only going to be gone a week. So we packed enough clothes for a week. My dad thought we were only going to be gone for a week. And I don't see my dad again for, 10 years, something like that.
His mom took the kids and moved to Panama City, Florida. And they moved in with her parents. Her dad was just as crazy, super strict, and pretty abusive. Just to give you an idea, they weren't allowed to eat any of Grandpa's food, and they weren't allowed to make any noise after dark. And he was very strict on how much water they could use. For instance, he wouldn't even let them fill up the bathtub. And both Brett and his sister Denise did not want to be around Grandpa when he gets angry.
We had no soap.
Right.
We had really very little clothes. I mean, two pairs of panties. And you weren't allowed to wash them.
Or you'd have to wash them by hand.
There was that, you know. I remember going over to Pizza Hut and stealing the soap from Pizza Hut so I could bring it back and wash my underwear in the sink with the soap. You know, but I had to be careful because if he knew I was doing that, I was wasting water and that would set him off. And if you set him off, his goal was to kill you.
And it was. I mean, we had that round table in the kitchen upstairs in their house. And there were times when he would get the butcher knife on you and you'd do the little dance around the table until he got tired. And then he would finally sit down and he would look at you and say, "Don't let me catch you, I'll kill you."
Or he'd get really upset and then he'd go looking for his gun. And that's time for you to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd leave for a while and come back in a few hours.
Your parents are sorrier than whale shit and we should not have to feed you.
And they didn't want to feed us.
No.
So, mom had been gone for a few days. She started partying, using drugs, everything else like she was doing. We didn't have any food in the house. And, you know, I was a guy that was scared that mom wasn't going to come home because she'd tell us that we'd find her dead someplace, that she was going to commit suicide, that she'd given up her life for us, everything else. So she'd been gone. I'm worried she's not coming back. Denise never worried at all. Denise was just always mad at her. We were living downstairs from my grandfather. He had converted the downstairs into apartments, and we weren't allowed to go upstairs to eat. They just wouldn't let us. And this one time, I was 10. My sister Denise was 9. So Denise walks in one day, and she's got a pack of pork chops in her hand. And I was like, "Where'd you get that?" And she was like, "I stole it." And I'm like, "Show me how you did that, sister." So she takes me over to A&P, and she shows me how she's stuffing, you know, meat and everything down her pants, and I'm like, "Well, we can eat." So we start stealing food, and we look across the way because we were wanting to make sandwiches. That's the actual story, is we were wanting to make sandwiches. Well, you can't stuff a loaf of bread down your pants. Well, Kmart was across the way, so we went over there and stole a hoodie so we could stuff bread down the sleeves of the hoodie. That's when we found out, hey, we can shoplift clothes, and then books, games, jewelry, toys, all that stuff. Mom finally comes home and sees, you know, the new Intellivision that I'm playing and everything else. And where'd that come from? And I looked at her and said, "Oh, we found it." And she's like, "No, you didn't find that." Denise stands up, never lies at all. Denise stands up, "We stole it." My mom looks at my sister she's like, "Show me how you did it." Not only does she join us, but she goes and gets her mom to join us as well. So it's grandmother, mom, me and my sister taking these road trips to different malls to steal clothes. And well, they stole clothes and jewelry. I'd always go to the bookstore first and steal books because I like to read a lot. And we were at the Fort Henry Thomas Mall in Bristol, Tennessee. They had dropped me off at the B. Dalton bookstore. They had went in JCPenney's, and we were supposed to meet back at the vehicle, I think like at 1:30. Well, I came back with a load of books. Nobody's there. So I'm standing around about 30 minutes like, "Okay, where are they?" And I'm only like 10. So I'm like, "Where are they?" So I wait a while. Finally, I'm like, okay, I got to go in and find them. So I stuff the books under the blazer, walk into JCPenney's. As I'm walking in, there's two security guards standing right in the entryway there. And I hear my name, Brett Johnson, come over one of the walkie-talkies. And I'm like, hey, that's me. And they're like, that's you. And I was like, yeah, they're like, come with us. So I go, they take me to the security room, and my mom and grandmother, they're huddled in a corner, crying, screaming, telling everybody they didn't do it, didn't mean to. This is the first time we've ever done it. Denise is in the opposite corner. I mean, she's just, I mean, Denise is ballistic, just angry, staring holes through like she could kill them right there. That's the first crime that I committed there.
That marked the end of his sister's criminal behavior. She totally stopped shoplifting after that. But this was the beginning of Brett's criminal career. He continued to shoplift and steal, never getting caught for it either. And he watched as his mom did criminal acts too. His mom was shoplifting, and he learned she was drug trafficking, and she would sometimes call random people to try to get them to donate to a charity, but they were really just giving her money instead. And this is called charity fraud. She even tried to steal heavy equipment sometimes. She was kind of an opportunistic criminal, getting involved with whatever came her way, and Brett was watching it all. And after some years of this, Brett started talking with his dad again, but only over the phone. His dad had his own issues. He was breaking the law and stuff too. And when Brett was 15, he got his first taste of jail.
When I was 15, I was in Eastern Kentucky. My dad had called. I'd called him, and he said he was getting married. And I was always of the opinion that I was going to, you know, that dad was going to save us. So, he said he was getting married. I went to the I was at the hospital on a payphone there. Got in an elevator and ended up assaulting a woman that got on the elevator with me. I just I guess I snapped or whatever. I don't know. I don't know. I was 15 at that point. I was charged with assault in the first degree, so they put me in solitary for 6 months.
Why do you think the news from your father getting married caused this?
I think that was the last, and I don't think it caused it. I think that it was, looking back now, I think that I had taken mentally as much as I could, because it turns out the woman looked a lot like mom. So I think that I had just, with that final news of dad, I think that I'd always been the guy that thought I was going to, you know, it took me to save me. And I've lived my entire life like that. If you're going to do something, do it yourself. But when I heard that from him, I think that child in me, that small part of having hope of somebody saving me was finally gone. And maybe I realized that that just wasn't going to happen. So I don't like to make excuses for that, because it was a horrible, horrible thing. And I've lived my life, I mean, every single day I've thought about that, and I wanted to mention that because I think it's important. I think it's important to the story and everything.
This is going to be a heavy episode. Brett pleads guilty to this assault and goes to juvenile detention for a few months and starts attending high school in Hazard, Kentucky. This is where he finds a teacher who saw potential in Brett. He excelled in academics and drama in high school, and because he was doing well, he actually stayed away from crime, for the most part. He graduated high school and wanted to be an actor, and he had some scholarship offers, but ended up just going to the community college there. He gets a part in a play, then the head of the theater department from the San Jose State University in California came to see his play and saw Brett's performance.
As soon as he sees it, he comes up to me and he's like, I'll give you a full ride scholarship if you want to come to San Jose State right now. And I looked at him, I was like, done, let's do this. So I agree to the scholarship. He tells me it's going to be great. He actually says, hey, you're a big fish in a small pond. I'll make sure you're a big fish in a big pond. You'll go someplace. So I was like, let's do this. So he's like, I'll be back in a week. So he leaves, he flies back down in a week. He drives to my house. We were living in Airport Gardens at that point. I'm shooting basketball with some friends. He pulls up. I come over to meet him. I was like, hey, let me walk in and I'll introduce you to my mom. And he's like, no. He said, I can go in and meet her. I was like, all right. So he goes in And he's in there, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. He comes out, never says a word, gets in the car, leaves. And I didn't know what had happened. Find out, I don't know, a couple weeks later, I find out that my mom, he goes in to meet her and talk to her and tell her, you know, the opportunity that I've gotten, everything else like that. She pulls a knife on him and says, you know, I will, she had this line she used to say, she said, I will cut you from gizzard to sternum, and you're not going to steal my son from me. That scares the man to death. And of course, the scholarship and all that goes out the window at that point. That, I don't know, I guess part of that kind of broke me of leaving.
There were similar problems going on with his sister. She was older by this point and going to college too, but her mom had a tight grip on her and didn't want her to go away and was doing very manipulative things to keep her. But the people at the college, about 90 minutes away, saw a glimpse of what Denise was going through and gave her a full scholarship and a place to stay and even protected her. This gave Denise the chance she needed to escape the bad gravity of her mom and get an education and get on her feet. She became a teacher, and a pretty good one, winning Teacher of the Year even, and she stayed clear of any criminal behavior.
So I continued in community college, had a girlfriend that was a preacher's daughter, and those were very, very decent people. For the most part, I didn't think about breaking the law or anything else. That relationship fell apart after 5 years, and I met my first wife. Her name was Susan. Susan wanted out of home, out of Hazard, Kentucky, and I knew that I kind of used that as a...
We'll be right back. harmonies in the wind. We're rugging up for winter. Putting out the bins. In cold and windy weather. Down by the docks. Leave all the silent sea ships. Crates are stored on blocks. When I only the rats live. Sail me down the river till we reach the shore. Dive into the center, eating up the car.
You can see. товарищ, мы склонны думать, что только в одной нашей стране осуществлена подлинная демократия. Демократия – это значит власть народа. Это значит, что хозяином страны становятся сами трудящиеся. Можно быть хозяином в силу того, что над страной захвачена политическая власть. И в этом смысле мы уже настоящие хозяева и страны, и судеб народа. Но быть хорошим хозяином – это значит уметь хозяйничать. И для того, чтобы управлять судьбами такой колоссальной республики, даже союза республик, нам необходимы чрезвычайно острые, чрезвычайно многообразные знания, которыми был бы обогащен всякий гражданин, ибо всякий гражданин при нашей подлинной демократии должен быть участником в управлении страной. Вот почему задачи просвещения являются для нас столь бесконечно важными. Мы должны заботиться не только о том, чтобы победить неграмотность, не только о том, чтобы дать элементарные сведения о мире, но и о поднятии квалификации сельского и городского труда, а также о политическом воспитании, о превращении каждого самого отсталого крестьянина подлинного сознательного гражданина социалистической республики. Огромные трудности, встречаемые на нашем пути, трудности нашей бедности, трудности неподготовленности учителей, но все это будет побеждено, потому что народные массы жаждут знания, и правительство отвечает им от всего сердца на эти пожелания. Мы строим наш натиск на твердыни науки, нашу борьбу за то, чтобы вооружиться знаниями для дальнейшей борьбы за всю нашу цель, во всей ее полноте. Мы строим эту борьбу с двух концов. Борясь за ликвидацию неграмотности, создавая сеть элементарных школ с одной стороны, а с другой, вводя высшие учебные заведения на самые высоты научного образования, кость от кости и плоть от плоти трудового народа, нашу новую красную интеллигенцию. Она переполнила теперь, войдя туда через рабфаки, аудитории, лаборатории университетов, она готовится войти в жизнь на смену старшему поколению, она послужит громадным помощником, инструктором для народа в переходный момент, и при ее помощи народ сумеет во всей своей массе овладеть и знаниями, и всем необходимым ему для того, чтобы оказаться полным победителем в начатой им борьбе.
плохим стало, куда мен эксцесс? Следа сказа из лет сторищ, так дальше остален процесс. Как с Берлины стены в Вольке, вонзить их видом мало в тот флюхт.
Ça dérange qui ?